So vaulting into democracy and human rights, you're probably the first to tell us this side of the story. Thank you so much for your wonderful lecture. We now have time to take questions. I think you will take them in German as well. If necessary, we can translate. And kindly, one of our undergrads, Mr. Baumgartner, will give the mobile microphone to anybody who wants to ask a question. Does it already work? Yes. Wonderful. As you have to leave at 8 sharp, so if anybody else among the students would be so kind to take the microphone from Mr. Baumgartner at 8, it would be very kind, perhaps you, one of you. Thank you. So please, is there a person who wants to ask the first question, Birgitta Baratza?
Thank you very much, Sophia, for this wonderful talk, a very innovative one. I was thinking when you mentioned the choices which are declared in this Universal Declaration of Human Rights, these did not apply or have not applied, still don't apply, to societies where not the individual subject is the core of society, but families, clans, and so on. So isn't what is the link then probably also to individualism in your talk, which I think might be interesting?
Yes. I couldn't agree more that individualism, in a sense, lurks behind the whole story because it is about the construction of a new way of thinking about the individual subject as somebody who has internal preferences and whose uniqueness or individuality comes in some ways from having those preferences and being able to live according to them, from what you wear to what you eat, but also to who you vote for, what ideas you ascribe to. And so one of the interesting things about human rights ideas, I think, is that they, in a sense, in the modern formulation, take for granted that most societies do think of the individual as somebody who seeks this kind of independence in choice making in a wide variety of realms, ranging from the political to the familial, even the choice of partner, choice of profession, choice of place to live. The list goes on, and if you start looking closely, that idea is, in a sense, the link between many of the things that are described as rights. Rights, I don't think, from the beginning are thought of in this way. I think if you look at 17th century or 18th century discussions of rights, choice is not the centerpiece. But this conception of the individual, in a sense, creeps into rights language. And I would now say that it's sort of the dominant conception, which sometimes makes it an odd fit for societies in which, for instance, choice of spouse seems like an odd right to be angling for in a world in which family units are constructed and conceptualized quite differently. So, yes.
Thomas Stockinger from the Department of History.
Well, let me also thank you for an absolutely brilliant talk that I found inspiring, that touched on so many things that have been preoccupying me for years now. But since I'm required to ask a question when they give me the microphone, to Birgitta Baratza's suggestion of individualism, I'd like to add, is, in your view, moral relativism an important part of this new definition of choice? Because I think older conceptions of choice generally emphasize a very clear distinction between the right choice and all the others are wrong. Hercules at the crossroads, it did matter which one he chose. Whereas in your Cotillion example, it's so beautifully clear that the act of choosing is the point, and the consequences are of no issue at all in that description, or they don't exist. Everybody gets a dancing partner, everybody dances, the thing is reversible, it's repeatable.
That's wonderfully apt example. I think of it as a shift in certain ways for what used to be called Hercules. Let me stay in the right place, sorry. No choice in this, right? What was sometimes called Hercules's choice is a very common trope in 17th, 18th century. It's in opera, it's in painting, it's in literature. And Hercules's choice is to do the right and the good thing or to make the wrong decision and be led astray. It's not a choice in the modern sense like a menu of options or like the cotillon, exactly. So you might say that there, free will is, of course, an ancient theme. And the idea of choice, in certain sense, is what does define humans, the ability to make decisions about their actions. But this idea of a kind of array of possibilities in which it is not always clear what is the right thing to do, and when you read a menu and you order off of it, there's not a correct choice. There are only sort of social conventions. I think that's the innovation that comes with both a modern conception of the individual and a modern conception of freedom.
Sorry. Milo Schwitz.
Many thanks for that really inspiring talk at the crossroads of at the crossroads of so many disciplines and social environments. So there is the pre-modern dance with very often connected to early modern court ceremonial, regulated not only by social rules, but also legally regulated. And that is where I would like to come up with a question. How far would you go with your comparison and story of some kind of a co-evolution, maybe, of those different regulatory fields or fields of social conduct? Because you were making some kind of analogies between political choices and choices within consumer culture. Yeah. So I'm asking now a jurist's question, because consumer protection has totally turned the private law in the late 20th and 21st century, because we see some kind of a asymmetry of power, and we are enabling the consumer to have more power. So there is not only the autonomy, but we see a lack of autonomy also. So how about the rituals and imbalances of power in the societies, and also gender balances within the 19th century bourgeois and pre-modern court culture?
That is a terrific point. And I think what I tried to emphasize is that this story of this expanding notion of freedom, it has a kind of ironic side to it, which is that it requires more and more rules or laws, both formal laws and informal laws, depending on the domain. One could, I think, tell the story of the vast expansion in the 20th century, in particular, of law as having something to do with the expansion of choice, because choice always needs some kind of regulation. The more consumer goods you have, for instance, the more there have to be rules about what's an acceptable consumer good, for instance, what can be sold and to whom and in what conditions. And there have to be some restrictions around choice, things you can't sell, things for which there isn't a market. And sometimes, I believe, the focus on only the freedom side disguises in various ways, as you say, kinds of unfreedoms, either because of restrictions on what the options are or restrictions on who can do the choosing, or even lousy sets of options for many people, that they're told you have a choice, but the choices are not very good ones. You know, if you two contaminated water and poisonous air, I don't know, would be a bad choice, right? I'm interested in how freedom and unfreedom, in a sense, have evolved together, even though the rhetoric tends to stress that all of this discussion of choice is about freedom of choice.
Moment, wo ist das Mikro? Okay.
Nachher. Brigitte?
Ja, kannst du noch kurz warten? Okay. Thomas Weinig.
Okay. So many thanks. I was thinking about what happens before the choice, so what informs the choice. And thereby I was thinking about the place of knowledge and judgment in your equation. I find it striking to think about a very private, if I may say, setting like the dance, as opposed to a quite public setting as the ballot. And I was thinking about what kind of knowledge in either of the cases was between the lines, so taken for granted that the consumer of those lines knew. So in both cases, that can be quite explicit in terms of what does the public good actually mean in terms of polities, in terms of state knowledge in a larger sense. And in the other case, so partner choosing guides of the early 19th century saying, well, you have to choose according to those and those criteria. So I think these are just loose thoughts, but I wonder if you could say a little bit more how you spot, if there's any development you spot there, and what's your view on that other side of the decision making process.
So I think two interesting points that perhaps I can comment on in what you just said. One is that something similar about the dancing and the voting is that though you describe them as sort of public and private in different ways, they both involve private behavior in public settings. So one of the odd things about voting is that all of these people here have gone to a public space in order to then draw a curtain across them and do something quite private. And the point of their privacy is important, but the fact they're performing it in public is as well. And the dancing similarly involves a kind of tension, I think, between intimacy and a large public witnessing, in some way, the performance of the intimacy, which brings us to that question you're saying, what are these people really doing when they're choosing? Is this judging? Is it deciding? There are a lot of terms that we use, and they tend to overlap. But one of the things that really worried early people who wrote about choice in the early modern world in particular is that choosing was very different from judging, because in judging, you made a reasoned decision with all the information in front of you, generally in consultation with others. Whereas, and this is why choosing sometimes gets sort of understood to be female behavior early on, and why people are sometimes nervous about this kind of private voting, is that it will be a little bit more like acting on whim or taste, and therefore have no basis in reason, that people will make choices that they can't explain, that they'll have a preference for somebody or a preference for a particular fabric that doesn't come from any kind of reasoned judgment, but is just a feeling of some kind. And women who choose early on as shoppers, for instance, the verb to go shopping is a neologism in English of the late 18th century, and in French, there isn't a, often the same expression gets used in English, to go a shopping. And it always is a little bit pejorative because it's about kind of picking in a sort of fanciful way as if just on your whims. And so there's much tension always around when choice is real judgment and with knowledge behind it and when choice is just a fancy. So yes, that's a theme of significance.
Gerald Stutz.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I would like to thank you very much, Professor Rosenfeld, for your wonderful lecture.
Thank you.
And I'm very grateful that you have come to Vienna to give this lecture tonight.
Greatly my pleasure.
I would also like to thank very much Dean Tony Vogt and Professor Jobst and Professor Becker for your very kind remarks on my behalf. Well, I would like to say just to add a very few observations. Some of them autobiographical, actually.
Good.
Let me start with something about the history, which I know virtually nothing, and that is dancing. I went as a very young person, in fact at the age of 15, to dancing school in Vienna, and some of you may be interested to learn something which presumably most of you will not know, that in January of 1945, 2 months, 3 months before the end of the war, dancing schools in Vienna were open, and one could enroll in dancing classes, which I did with a series of friends of mine in January 1945. And I also recall that, which is even more amazing, that in that group, a whole series, perhaps 15 to 20 young men in Nazi uniforms were there, all coming from the so-called Napola schools, in which there were gathered future leading persons, leading men of the Nazi regime. But there were a group of them able to go to dancing school as late as January 1945. But the one thing I really would... this class, this dancing class, stopped, of course, in about March 1945. It reopened very soon, early in May 1945. The Nazi uniforms of where we all had all disappeared, and there were Russian officers and soldiers coming in and trying to get some girls, who were pushed out very, very quickly by the director of the school. But why do I really want to speak about a dancing experience? Because it involves the experience of choice, the passive experience of choice, because in every one of these dancing classes, every time, there was one moment where the so-called Damenwahl appeared. And prior to the rise of feminism, Damenwahl was a steady, a firm part of every dancing class. So, of course, I was very curious and nervous by whom I would be chosen or picked. And I do remember a very funny incident that a young lady who was absolutely unknown to me approached me for dancing, and then she started conversation. Did you also go to elementary school in Strohgasse in the third district? And I said yes, and she was in the same class as I was. And that helped our later conversation. But anyway, an experience of choice, a passive experience of choice, but an interesting one. But to go back to another theme, political choices. Mm-hmm. And of course, you very rightly at the beginning mentioned the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of 1948. In fact, this will be the 70th anniversary this year, in December, early December. And you very clearly pointed out that the catalog of the Universal Declaration really includes rights to choices, rights to choices. And the closeness of choice and right has been made very clear in your lecture. I don't want to refer to many of those choices which you did mention. I should perhaps mention that the choice of religious freedom, of course, you mentioned the Reformation, and which first started really only with the choice of freedom of the rulers of particular countries, cuius regio, eius religio, but then the development of religious freedom, which in a way came to an end in the Western world very late with the declaration of the Catholic Church of the Second Vatican Council in 1965, Dignitatis Humanae, a very late recognition by the Catholic Church of religious freedom.
Yes, it's very late.
Now, I would now go to my last point, which considers political choice, the choice in the act of suffrage, the choice to elect persons. And again, I would like to be a little bit autobiographical for a moment. Mm-hmm. Being born in 1929, I went to the Nazi period as a boy and a young man. I was not yet 16, I was almost 16, mm-hmm. when the Nazi period was over. And the political non-freedom of the Nazi era has been a experience of my youth, which has impressed me, influenced me, formed me very, very deeply. I do recall, not as an active participant, of course, the so-called plebiscite in April of 1938, mm-hmm. where very often, of course, voters were asked, well, you don't really need to go into the cell. You can give us your vote quite openly. It goes mm-hmm. more quickly. So the total unfreedom, the and the taking away of the possibility of choice, mm-hmm. Which was practiced at that time. But the non-expression of the non-possibility of choice in the Nazi period has impressed me so deeply that I think I have since then, since 1945 and after, I have a part in cases of illness. I have not missed a single possibility where I had the freedom of choice, mm-hmm. whether these were student elections or political elections or church elections mm-hmm. or elections in all kinds of associations. I don't think I've ever missed a possibility of indicating my choice. Mm. And one thing which in the present situation rather disturbs me is the problem of the non-voters. And the rather increasing, often increasing problem, or the fact of non-voting, voting, political voting, is the most important peaceful way of choosing mm-hmm. A government, of choosing people by whom you want to be governed. And I would like to close with a reference to a quote by the well-known writer Elias Canetti mm-hmm. in his book Masse und Macht, Masses and Power, where he speaks about this and makes the all-important distinction between peaceful choice and violent choice. Outside of democratic voting, Carnegie says there is only the alternative of violent choice, that is mm-hmm. the exercise of violence and the possibility of violent death. Mm-hmm. And he very impressive words, which I first will quote in the original German, he says, der Moment, in dem man wirklich wählt, ist beinahe heilig. Heilig sind die versiegelten Urnen, die die Wahlzettel enthalten. Heilig der Vorgang des Zählens. Das Feierliche in all diesen Verrichtungen entstammt dem Verzicht auf den Tod als Instrument der Entscheidung. I've never come across another passage where the alternative vote or violence with the threat of death has been as clearly expressed. I will briefly put it in English. The moment of voting is almost holy, and the holiness or the of all these rituals comes from the renunciation of death as instrument of decision. With every single voting ticket, death is taken away and is eliminated. That very clear juxtaposition, voting or violence, mm-hmm. Is for me one of the most important questions within the field you have been talking about. Thank you very much indeed again.
Thank you so much for those terrific comments. you bring up so many important questions in one statement there. It's hard to know quite where to respond, but I agree that is a beautiful and vital distinction, and one that we need to hold on to in the present moment, certainly, this idea that voting and democratic freedoms can't really ever be taken for granted, that we can question how effectively they're working or not in various moments. But I think at the moment it's, again, apparent how vital the idea of a peaceful process that there's widespread agreement has a certain fairness to it as a peaceful way to transfer power and to decide socially collective important decisions. We have not found an improvement on that. On this question, though, of the low rates of voting is a very interesting one. And I do wonder about places like Australia, which have compulsory voting, whether this is, in a sense, a better or a worse solution. In some ways, one measures much more the collective opinion if voting is compulsory. On the other hand, compelling people to choose has a certain irony to it, because it says you have no choice but to choose. So I think that's something that, you know, will be interesting to see how democracies evolve in this century, whether they move towards mechanisms for increasing voting, or whether we will end up with a world in which a small number of people do most of the deciding for everyone else. But thank you very much for those very generous remarks. All the way up, I'm afraid.
My name is Martin Buchinger. Mm-hmm. I want to make a point about not voting. It's a thing that I experienced myself kind of regarding the presidential elections in Austria, where in the end there were only two candidates left, of which I couldn't support neither. Mm. So there was really the point where I had only the choice of going to the vote and casting a white, so yeah. Yeah, yeah. Without any choice, or not going there and not even throwing it in. It was really one of the most interesting decisions. In the end, I decided to go there but not to cast a vote on one of both candidates because I couldn't support either one. And that's probably the thought process that most people who refuse to vote go through.
Yes, this is an interesting question. And I do see that there's symbolic weight in showing up and not voting for the options before you, but not staying home either, which is to say, I don't participate at all. I mean, I think it has something to do with how you envision voting. Do you envision voting as an expressive action in which you are expressing your own political values in some external form? Or do you consider voting a practical measure in which you think, look, neither of these candidates is the person who really represents what I believe, but I see this as a practical way to make a decision given the options that are before me, and I do see that one of these options would have more catastrophic consequences than the other, then if you felt the second way, you might decide to vote even though you don't like the options before you. If you feel voting is expressive, you might decide not to. And this debate occurred as well in the United States in the last election. To my mind, the consequences of not having voted in the last election suggest the importance of the second kind of voting, which is to say a kind of voting where you don't have to love the options before you, but you have to decide that one is simply qualitatively substantially worse than the other. But I think that's alongside the question of compulsory voting, I do think there should be and will be an ongoing conversation about why we vote. Is it in this expressive mode, or as simply a practical mechanism for determining among the possibilities before us without resorting to violence.
Hello. Thank you for your lecture. It was very informational. I was just wondering. My name is Zara, and I'm originally from Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if, because some parts were difficult for me to understand, because I was also thinking, if choice is not freedom, then what is? And I was wondering mm-hmm. if choice is an abstraction of the word freedom. Mm-hmm. And then I was kind of also thinking if it's a language problem, because I tried to think the same question in my native language, which is Urdu, mm-hmm. and I realized that the translation of the word choice is preference, equals to preference in that language, which is why we in Urdu we never use the word choice for voting. We always use what would be equivalent to freedom.
Uh-huh.
There is only one word.
Very interesting.
And when I translated this in my head, it became very clear to me what I was kind of trying to understand the difference between. Because in English, we are thinking very clearly about choice as freedom. Mm-hmm. For I would have liked to think that, oh, it's the same thing. What's really the difference? But I just wanted to share this.
Yes, thank you very much for that interesting comment. And I think that's where, ideally, this would be a project that one would have to really look across cultures and across languages. Certainly because choice, though there are cognates in every language, they have different implications. And the very fact, as you say, not only the implications different, they get used in different circumstances, means that in some ways this kind of universalizing language of human rights doctrines, which are usually rooted in French, German, English conceptions of vocabulary, sometimes must have very, very different implications in different languages. And your example about preferences and about voting is an extremely interesting one. I think should make us aware of the importance of not, in a sense, fetishizing particular terms, but thinking about kind of groups of possibilities, even within English. If you look at a dictionary, or even within French, the meaning of the word does evolve over time. So that whether you look with synchronically or dichronically, you will see different implications across time. What interests me is that early notions of freedom in English often mean non-domination, that you have autonomy, nobody else has authority over you. But that's quite different from thinking of freedom as the chance to make choices. Those are quite different conceptions of choice and of freedom. And there's a shift. It doesn't happen in any one text or overnight, but there's a long process by which that shifts. And it'd be interesting to know, too, if in Urdu there were kind of fluctuations in meaning across time, and whether the influence of other languages across time on Urdu changed notions of freedom or choice.
So I think this was a wonderful last question and last answer, which perfectly closes the evening. May I remind you that you will have a chance to listen to the audio of this lecture and this evening at our website from a couple of days on. And we are all looking forward to the written version of your paper that you will also find, as all the others, on the website of Gerald Sturz Lectures. Thank you once again, Sophia Rosenfeld. Thank you to you all for coming, and have a good evening.
Thank you all again as well. Wonderful. Thank you. you so much for that incredibly kind introduction, too. It went well beyond the...